Good morning, Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC AM and FM and WNYC.org. So there was a big global conference in South Africa to solve climate change, and they came to an agreement on Sunday. But what did they accomplish? The verdict on that seems to be that it was better than the proverbial poke in the eye with a sharp stick, but not close to a success. Joining me now to talk about the ups and downs of Durban is Brian Walsh, a senior writer for Time magazine, covering energy and the environment. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Andrew.
So the downside for Durban is that there is still no post-Kyoto plan, but the upside is that everyone has agreed to keep negotiating?
Yes, that's essentially what happened. Basically, you had an agreement to continue trying to negotiate what would eventually be a bigger deal to succeed the Kyoto Protocol. The big concern with Kyoto, of course, is that it only actually accounts for developed countries. It, of course, doesn't include the United States. Now, the big developing countries like China and India actually are responsible for the bulk of carbon emissions. That's going to increase going forward. So the question has always been, how do you bring them into the fold? And basically at Durban, we sort of took a step down that process. But, you know, at this point, it's still a long way from actually getting there.
It seems like agreeing to keep talking is such a unsatisfying conclusion.
It is, actually, and especially when it took them 36 hours beyond the scheduled end of the conference to actually get to that point. You sort of have to wonder why they couldn't have done that earlier. But it sort of underscores the fact that, you know, I think top-down treaties, top-down agreements internationally may not be the best way to deal with this when it comes to climate change. I mean, ultimately, it's going to be down to individual countries. What will Washington do? What will New Delhi do? What will Beijing do? What are they willing to do? And, you know, I don't think it's going to work to force them internationally to do that. That's going to have to come really from the ground up.
But a lot did happen after Kyoto, right? I mean, the Kyoto Accords went into effect. European countries in particular made a lot of changes, not all of them popular. So it wasn't like that was purely going to have happened without any international spotlight on the issue.
That's certainly one argument. I mean, definitely the COP talks, the annual UN climate talks, keep talking about this and they keep it focused on this issue. And, you know, beyond the sort of big clashes over where will we or will we not have a deal, there's a lot of really important work done on the sort of smaller things, whether it's, in this case in Durban, it was dealing with avoided deforestation, trying to reduce deforestation, which also contributes to climate change, or also attempting to sort of flesh out the mechanisms for a green climate fund that would channel tens of billions of dollars eventually to the developing countries that are going to be hit by climate first and worst.
So how close were talks to falling apart completely in South Africa?
I mean, they were about as close as they ever get. I mean, as I said before, they went well over time. South Africa actually had to ensure that they'd have bigger planes to carry delegates home later because everyone was so was in danger of missing their flight. But at the same time, this seems to happen every year. I've gone to a number of these summits, and you know, you have back and forth for the first several days. The ministers show up towards the end. Everyone talks about how there will never be a deal, never be a deal. This will be the year it falls apart. And then they manage to come up with something, usually some kind of face-saving or some kind of agreement like that happened here. So I think that was always going to happen. They're always going to negotiate hard at the same time.
How differently did these talks, you mentioned you've been to a lot of them, did it feel, I mean, you know, I think out of last year of Cancun, there was sort of widespread depression, maybe even more so coming out of Copenhagen, where President Obama went and a number of world leaders showed up. What would you say the mood was leaving South Africa?
I think the mood was relief that you know, it hadn't fallen apart, that these summits would continue, and they had actually achieved some progress. At the same time, we've also gotten a lot more realistic about what can be accomplished here at these summits. In Copenhagen 2 years ago, there was a real push in the months leading up to it from environmental groups, from people in the UN, to say we would seal the deal. This would be the summit where we would create the new agreement that would really solve climate change. And ultimately, that was never really realistic. Now, I think negotiators, even environmentalists, come to these meetings with a bit more of a sense of realism about what can actually be accomplished. And they realize this will just be one step in what's going to be a really multi-decadal fight against global warming.
And you mentioned some of the new issues that came up this year, but is the fundamental problem still this issue of, you know, developing countries like China and India you know, sort of agreeing, not having to agree to accept these limits?
Absolutely. I mean, the issue with the Kyoto Protocol is it enshrines, I think, a division of labor that's not really meaningful in 2011, at a time when China, even though it's still a developing country, even though it's a country where, you know, hundreds of millions of people are still very poor, is the biggest carbon emitter in the world. India is not far behind. And so you simply can't do much about climate change if you only create a treaty that only deals with rich nations. At the same time, you know, China and India, they have a very strong argument here that they have not been responsible for the bulk of carbon emissions so far. They're still poor countries that need to focus on economic growth. And until we figure out how to essentially finesse that, how to solve that problem, we're going to be hitting up against the same issue over and over again.
And yet China last year, I mean, the data just came out last week, China is now the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases. Isn't that right?
That is absolutely true. But they're also doing quite a lot to deal with that. I mean, both in terms of improving energy efficiency, in terms of spending really hundreds of billions of dollars to boost their renewable energy industry. It's interesting that while you can see what negotiators may or may not be saying on the international stage, nationally, even in the U.S., we see renewable energy continue to grow. So countries are doing things. It's just that this U.N. system, in part because of this developed versus developing division, it's hard to create that kind of meaningful progress there.
Now, there was progress, you were saying, in two areas, including preventing deforestation. What happened with that?
Well, the idea is that every time you cut down a forest, especially in the tropics, you're essentially adding to climate change. You're adding carbon to the atmosphere. So maybe there's a way to essentially pay off tropical developing countries to keep those forests rather than cutting them down and use that as a way to reduce carbon emissions. And so the idea has always been to try to see how can we fold that sort of plant into the larger already existing carbon trading programs. This idea, it's called RED, or avoided deforestation. And what the Durban meeting did essentially was sort of begin to continue the process of fleshing that out. It's tricky because you have to figure out, you know, were these forests going to be cut down before? You know, what steps are they actually taking to prevent this from happening? But if you can do that, I mean, that's a great double win for both for the climate, but also for all the species and wildlife that depend on these forests.
Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehr. My guest is Brian Walsh of Time Magazine. We're talking about the just wrapped up talks in South Africa on climate change and what is in those agreements and what was part of those discussions. Now, what makes Europe so bound and determined to even sort of go it alone if they have to on climate change?
Well, I think you have a popular will there that's and a political class that is much more convinced about the reality of climate change and also much more convinced about the need to act on it. And at the same time, you know, Europe being a, you know, you have denser cities, less dependence on automobiles, less heavy industry than you have, say, in the United States or Canada, for that matter. You know, there's probably less of a pain that goes along with reducing those carbon emissions. So that's really what's been driving them. And, you know, they're committed to doing this regardless. The EU has a pledge on its own to reduce carbon emissions 20% by 2020. That's going to continue regardless. And now, of course, they at Durban also signed up essentially for another commitment period under the Kyoto Protocol. So that's why they're always the leaders really pushing this forward.
In the United States, there's polls showing that a pretty significant part of the population doesn't believe that climate change exists or is occurring. In fact, the numbers of people who believe in it, I think, dropped something like 20 percentage points between 2008 and now. And, you know, you see this very active debate within the Republican Party. Do you believe in climate change? Right now, as we speak, the Mitt Romney campaign is trying to ridicule Newt Gingrich for having once supported measures to control greenhouse gases. I'm wondering how that sort of compares to the political situation in the rest of the world. I mean, is that kind of debate going on in India and China, or have those countries come to a conclusion about climate change but are reacting against, you know, controls that they worry could hinder their economies?
The U.S. does seem to be, and really, you know, the Republican Party, because if you look at the public opinion polls, it's really very much in conservatives who've dropped over the past few years, is kind of an outlier when it comes to belief in climate change. If you go to India, if you go to China, certainly if you go to Europe, you won't see in the media, you won't generally see from politicians even this sense that climate change maybe doesn't exist. But, I mean, you know, to look at what's going on in China, look at what's going on in India, believing in climate change, knowing it's happening, doesn't necessarily mean that they will sign on for any kind of measure that they see as retarding their economic growth. I mean, that for them is still the foremost issue. They know that their governments depend on that, their people depend on it. So they can believe in climate change, but at the same time, you know, want to see developed countries take most of the burden on for reducing carbon emissions. The problem, of course, for climate change is that, you know, we will still see a lot of warming, even if developed countries reduce their emissions, if developing countries continue to grow without doing that.
Canada announced yesterday it's breaking with Kyoto. Now, I understand that wasn't a surprise. Maybe the timing was. Was this in any way to put pressure on other countries to come up with something better, or was this just about internal Canadian politics?
This is mostly about internal Canadian politics, as you said. I mean, we had known this was going to happen for a while, and apparently Canada actually did put off the sort of formal declaration that they were leaving Kyoto until after the summit in order to avoid taking some of the focus away from it. But ultimately, you know, Canada is run by a conservative government right now. Actually, a government that's probably more conservative than the U.S., and it's also a country that now more and more depends on oil and natural gas. And so you see, you know, those politics changing the fact of Canada. And also, it had been very clear that they had no chance of meeting their Kyoto goals. They were well above that. And so they say that by actually formally withdrawing, they can avoid billions of dollars worth of penalties that would have accrued to them if they had stayed in Kyoto and not met those goals.
And so what happens now, between now and 2015?
Well, the process continues. There'll be another UN climate change summit at Qatar next year, which is interesting because Qatar has the highest per capita greenhouse gas emissions in the world. Right now, the goal is by 2015, you start the process of negotiating a new deal. By 2015, you hopefully have actually done that. But what we've known from the past is that deadlines are made to be broken when it comes to the UN climate process. So really what we have to go back to is, what will these countries do on their own? You really won't see change, say, from the U.S. on the international stage until you've seen it on the national stage. And, of course, as you pointed out, with the way the Republican Party is right now, it's going to be hard to see that happening. And that's going to really keep progress back, I think.
All right. And we will have to leave it there. Thanks so much to Brian Walsh of Time Magazine for coming to join us to talk about the conclusion of the climate change talks in South Africa. We'll continue to talk science in the next segment. The God particle. Do you know what it is? Do you know what today's discovery means? We'll find out right after this.